This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Lexus and the Olive Tree by Thomas L. Friedman. Narrated by George Wilson.
Part 2. Plugging into the System. Chapter 8. Das Kapital 6.0. Moscow, AP. A Moscow art gallery owner was questioned by prosecutors today after a life-sized cake depicting Vladimir Lenin was devoured by guests and art critics at a recent exhibition. The Moscow Times reported Tuesday that Sergei Tabarov was questioned by prosecutors after 20 communist members of parliament complained the cake violated laws against insulting national figures. AP, Moscow, September 8th, 1998. How much money are you carrying? The question was fired at me in a Jesse James tone of voice by an Albanian customs agent at Tirana Airport as I was trying to leave the country. As soon as the words were out of her mouth, I had the sinking feeling that I was about to be separated from my cash. I have $3,500, I said, patting my money belt.
$3,500, she repeated, her eyes lighting up.
He has $3,500, she said to her male colleague, who was standing next to her at the baggage X-ray machine.
Where are you from? He asked me, apparently trying to size up how vulnerable I was and to make sure I wasn't a diplomat. I told him I was a writer for the New York Times.
The New York Times? The customs man repeated, as he gave me the once-over.
Let him go.
Who'd have thunk that the New York Times carried such clout in Tirana? I practically ran onto the plane. I had reason to be nervous. I had been to this play before, in another country, where the rule of law was also not exactly king. Iran. Only there, it didn't have such a happy ending. There, it began the same way at Tehran International Airport, as I was trying to get through customs at 4 a.m. I was ordered by a customs agent to open my suitcase and hand him my customs declaration form. On it was a line for how much cash you are carrying, and I filled in the exact amount, $3,300, which I still had on me. Since American credit cards aren't accepted in Iran, I had to bring a lot of cash. The thin, mustachioed Iranian customs agent perused the form and then said to me with a lean, hungry look,
Mister, you can take only $500 out of the country.
Oh, no, I said. What do I do? The Iranian customs agent leaned over and whispered in my ear,
For $300, I can take care of it.
There was a long line of Iranians behind me watching this whole scene, all, no doubt, knowing exactly what was happening. I reached into my money belt and pulled out three crisp $100 bills and crumpled them into a ball in my hand.
Be careful, the customs agent hissed at me, as if somebody in the line behind us was actually going to report on what was happening.
Then the two of us pretended to be rummaging through my open suitcase, and with a quick snatch of his hand, he grabbed the $300 out of my fingers. It happened so fast, like a trout going for a fly, that you would have needed slow-motion instant replay to see it. Then with his other hand, he handed me a new blank customs form, which he asked me to fill out, declaring that I was taking only $500 out of the country. But even that wasn't the end. When I went upstairs to the boarding gate, I found that there was a body search after I went through the metal detector. I went into the cubicle behind the curtain, and the Iranian soldier there asked me to open my money belt. I panicked, thinking to myself, how am I going to explain the $3,000? What do I say? Hey, I already bribed your colleague downstairs to get this far, so get lost. Fortunately, he just looked at the money, rattled off something in Farsi, and let me go. Seasoned world travelers will know that my Iranian and Albanian adventures were hardly out of the ordinary. One encounters many manifestations these days of this phenomenon, best described as kleptocracy. Kleptocracy goes beyond the normal run-of-the-mill bribery and corruption that one can always find in developing countries, and to a lesser degree in developed ones as well. Kleptocracy is when many or all the key functions of the state system, from tax collection to customs to privatization to regulation, have become so infected by corruption that legal transactions become the exception rather than the norm. The norm, which becomes both tolerated and expected, is that officials at every level will use their powers to extort whatever money they can from citizens, investors, or the state itself. And citizens and investors will assume that the only way to get decisions or service is by paying someone off. States range from full-fledged kleptocracies, where the state is built around theft, such as Nigeria, to budding kleptocracies, where corruption is rampant, tolerated, and expected, but some legal and even democratic norms exist alongside it, such as India. The difference between full-fledged kleptocracy and budding kleptocracy is best illustrated by the old joke they like to tell around the World Bank about the Asian and African ministers of infrastructure who exchange visits to one another's countries. First, the African visits the Asian minister in his country, and at the end of the day, the Asian takes the African to his home for dinner. The Asian minister lives in an absolutely palatial residence, so the African minister asks his Asian counterpart, "Wow, how can you afford such a home on your salary?" The Asian minister takes the African over to a big bay window and points to a new bridge in the distance. "You see that bridge over there?" the Asian minister asks the African. "Yes, I see it," the African says. Then the Asian minister points a finger at himself and whispers, 10%, signaling 10% of the cost of the bridge went into his pocket. Well, a year later, the Asian went to visit the African minister in his country and found that he lived in an even more palatial home than his Asian counterpart. "Wow, how can you afford such a home on your salary?" the Asian asked the African. The African pulled his Asian counterpart over to the big bay window in his living room and pointed out to the horizon. "Do you see that bridge over there?" the African asked the Asian. "No, there is no bridge there," answered the Asian. "That's right," the African minister said, pointing to himself. 100%. What are the tangible signs that you are in either a budding or a full-fledged kleptocracy? Well, here are a few indicators that I've collected over the years. Kleptocracy is Moscow in 1995, and 1996, 1997, 1998, 1999, at a time when street crime was widespread in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union. As soon as I checked into the Penta Hotel in downtown Moscow, I took my cash down to the front desk and told the clerk there that I wanted to rent a hotel safe deposit box. I wasn't going to take any chances walking around Moscow with a pocket full of dollars. "Sorry," said the desk clerk. "They're all being used. There's a waiting list. Would you like me to put you down?" I had to laugh. A waiting list for hotel safe deposit boxes? It was like the punchline to a bad joke. How do you know when you're in a really dangerous city? Answer, when all the hotel safe deposit boxes have been taken. No wonder an investor I met in Moscow who had just bought into a Russian bank found that it had more security men than executives. He told me of a Western restaurant chain that had just dispatched a team of auditors to find out why its Moscow franchise was doing so much business and making so little money. They found that almost every employee was involved in some form of larceny, from chefs stealing hamburgers to managers taking kickbacks. Kleptocracy is the fact that in Albania, tax cheating was so rampant that in 1997, the 35th highest tax-paying company in the country was an Albanian-American pizza parlor.
and auto theft was so rampant that American officials estimated that 80% of the cars on the road in Albania were stolen from somewhere else in Europe. Kleptocracy is corruption in Russia, which goes so high into the Kremlin leadership that Russians joke about the man who drives into Moscow from the countryside and parks his new car right outside the Kremlin's Spassky Gate in Red Square. A policeman comes along and tells the man, "Look, you can't park here. This is the gate that all our leaders use." The man answers, "Don't worry, I locked my car." Kleptocracy is the story told to me by a friend who lived in Indonesia during the reign of the wildly corrupt Suharto family. He was a longtime reporter in Jakarta for a Singapore-based newspaper and had to regularly get his residency papers renewed. Corruption in Indonesia ran so deep, he explained to me, that officials would actually give you a receipt for your bribes. "Really, I get my immigration papers renewed each year. I pay the bribe and get a receipt. The accountants in my office want documentation, and the official I pay off provides it." It's no wonder that under Suharto, Indonesians had a saying, "If your neighbor steals your goat, whatever you do, don't take him to court, because by the time you get done paying off the police and the judges, you'll end up losing your cow as well." Kleptocracy is when officials and regulators who are responsible for overseeing rules believe the rules don't apply to them. Nayan Chanda, editor of the Far Eastern Economic Review, once related to me an experience he had visiting China. "I was in Beijing and we were riding on the Second Ring Road with a foreign ministry translator, his official driver, and our office assistant. As we were going down the highway, the foreign ministry driver suddenly made a U-turn and went straight up the highway entry ramp, honking furiously. The cars were coming down the entry ramp onto the highway, and we were veering around them. I was stunned and terrified. I said to the translator, 'What is he doing?' He answered that the driver had noticed a large traffic jam up ahead and decided to go around it by exiting on the entry ramp. I closed my eyes, ducked down behind the seat, and prayed that I was going to get out of this alive. I came out alive, but the thought occurred to me later, what about the foreign businesses that are all going into China? The Chinese sign a deal with them, get their technology, and then change the rules and tell them to go home. Will they get out alive?" Not if the regulators in China are on the take. The head of the China branch of one of the biggest Canadian banks told me in 1997 that the bank transferred several $1,000s once from its Hong Kong branch to its Shanghai branch, and it took 18 days for the transfer to clear. "We think we know what happened," the banker told me one day over lunch in Shanghai. "Someone in the central bank took the money, speculated with it on the Shanghai Stock Exchange for 17 days, and then put it back on the 18th day when the money showed up in our account." Kleptocracy is the billions of dollars that have been made in corrupt privatization programs throughout Eastern Europe and Russia, where tiny oligarchical elites, often in cahoots with local mafia and government officials, have managed to gain control of the formerly state-owned factories and natural resources at below-market rates, making them overnight billionaires. Real estate prices from Paris to Tel Aviv to London were all boosted by these Russian oligarchs and other rip-off artists who spirited assets out of that country at a staggering rate. America, when it was an emerging market, had its robber barons just as Russia now has its robber barons. But America's robber barons invested their money in America's stock market and real estate, whereas now, thanks to globalization and the free movement of capital, Russia's robber barons also invest their money in America's stock market and real estate, impoverishing their own country. Sometimes, though, kleptocracy isn't just rich oligarchs ripping off their country, but simply little people trying to survive in a country with no social safety net. I was once changing planes in Jakarta Airport and had to shuttle from the domestic terminal to the international one. I went out to the sidewalks with my bags and waited in line behind a sign that read, "Free Inter-Terminal Airport Shuttle." When the bus came, I loaded my bags and was the only one on the bus. As I walked past the driver to get off at the next terminal, he stopped me. "Mister," he said, and then pointed up to a crude sign he had scrawled above his seat in red magic marker. The sign said the ride cost 4,900 rupiah, about $2 at the time. I just shrugged and gave him the money. Kleptocracy was going in the summer of 1998 with John Burns, the New York Times bureau chief, in New Delhi to visit the Indian Parliament, where India's laws are promulgated. While we were waiting in the lobby to be cleared through, Burns noticed a book for sale in the Parliament bookstore. Who's Who of the Indian Parliament, with biographies and pictures of every Indian legislator. Burns decided he wanted to buy a copy. "Who do I go to buy a book?" Burns asked the clerk standing next to the book display. "Here, sir," the clerk said. 700 rupees." The man then left to retrieve a copy. When he returned, Burns asked him for a receipt. "We close at noon," the man said. "This will have to be an out-of-office sale," meaning no receipt. He then handed John the book and pocketed the money for himself. I found this rather charming, having to bribe someone in the lobby of the Indian legislature for a book about Indian lawmakers. I guess this explains why the Times of India reported on December 16, 1998, that an 18-month-long search in the corruption-riddled Indian state of Punjab had been called off. The search was for an official who could be given a $100,000 rupee, $2,380, award for providing honest government service in a state where everything from electricity hookups to public school enrollments requires paying a bribe to someone. But no official could be found who was appropriate for the award. Instead of identifying a recipient for the award, the New Delhi newspaper said the search produced evidence that may be used to bring charges against 300 corrupt officials. What does all this have to do with globalization? Let me try to answer by using some simple analogies from the world of computers. I like to compare countries to three parts of a computer. First, there is the actual machine, the hardware. This is the basic shell around your economy, and throughout the Cold War system, you had three kinds of hardware in the world: free market hardware, communist hardware, and hybrid hardware that combined features of both. The second part is the operating system for your hardware. I compare this to the broad macroeconomic policies of any country. In the communist countries, the basic economic operating system was central planning. There was no free market. The government decided how capital should be allocated. I call that communist economic operating system Das Kapital 0.0. In the hybrid states, the operating systems were various combinations of socialism, free markets, state-directed economies, and crony capitalism, in which government bureaucrats, businesses, and banks were all tied in with one another. I call this Das Kapital 1.0 to 4.0, depending on the degree of government involvement and the sophistication of the economy. Hungary, for instance, is Das Kapital 1.0. China is Das Kapital 1.0 in the hinterland and 4.0 in Shanghai. Thailand is Das Kapital 3.0, Indonesia is Das Kapital 3.0, and Korea is Das Kapital 4.0. Last come the big industrial capitalist systems.
Some of these have operating systems that are based on free markets but still have significant welfare state components. This group includes France, Germany, and Japan, and I call their operating systems Das Kapital 5.0. Others, though, such as the United States, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the United Kingdom, have liberalized their economies and have put on the full golden straitjacket. They have Das Kapital 6.0. In addition to the type of hardware enclosing an economy and its basic operating system, there is also the software it needs to get the most out of both. Software, for me, are all the things that fall broadly in the category of the rule of law. Software is a measure of the quality of a country's legal and regulatory systems, and the degree to which its officials, bureaucrats, and citizens understand its laws, embrace them, and know how to make them work. Good software includes banking laws, commercial laws, bankruptcy rules, contract laws, business codes of conduct, a genuinely independent central bank, property rights that encourage risk-taking, processes for judicial review, international accounting standards, commercial courts, regulatory oversight agencies backed up by an impartial judiciary, laws against conflicts of interest and insider trading by government officials, and officials and citizens ready to implement these rules in a reasonably consistent manner. In the Cold War, the big struggle was over whose hardware would dominate the world. The Soviets and Americans didn't pay all that much attention to how well their hardware was actually working in any particular Allied country. They just wanted to make sure that other countries were using their brand with their stickers. Indeed, a country could get by for a long time with a terrible operating system inside and corrupted software. Because the Soviets and Americans were so anxious to have it on their team, they would just subsidize it or offer free repairs, as long as that country stuck with the superpower's brand. Both superpowers lived in fear of the domino theory, which stated that if a certain key country would change hardware, all its neighbors would change too. This struggle ended with the collapse of the Cold War system. Suddenly, the communist, socialist, and even hybrid models were all discredited. Suddenly, we found ourselves at a remarkable moment in history. For the first time, virtually every country in the world had the same basic hardware, free market capitalism. Once that happened, the whole game changed. Countries no longer had to decide which hardware to choose, just how to make the best of the only hardware that seemed to work, free market capitalism. But there is a saying in the world of computer technology, the hardware always runs ahead of the software and the operating systems. That is, the engineers keep inventing faster and faster chips, and only later do the operating systems and the more sophisticated software get developed to really take advantage of this new hardware and get the most out of it. This dictum also applies to the world of globalization. But the world has witnessed, since the collapse of communism and socialism in Russia, Eastern Europe, and the Third World, is a large number of countries adopting the basic hardware of free markets and even plugging their hardware into the high-voltage electronic herd, but often without the operating system, software, and other institutions needed to effectively manage and rationally allocate the currents of capital and energy that can flow in and out once a country is connected to that herd. This, we are discovering, is one of the central problems in the transition from the Cold War system to the globalization system. The problem of premature globalization. I repeat, you cannot thrive today without plugging into the electronic herd and the supermarkets, and you cannot survive today unless you have an operating system and software that will allow you to get the most out of them and protect you from their worst excesses when they stampede. It was inevitable that as everyone moved to the same brand of hardware, free markets, there would be lags in how different countries developed their operating systems and the software to catch up.
Hey, it's easy to buy a computer, especially when there is only one brand. Any moron can go out to Computer City and pick one up. And in the transition from the Cold War system to the globalization system, many countries did just that, without ever thinking about whether they had the operating system and software to effectively operate that computer. These countries just said, "Hey, this looks easy. I'll just plug my dandy new hardware into this electronic herd right here." But it was actually much harder than it looked. It's easy to declare a free market in your country. What's difficult is to establish even-handed enforcement of equitable laws and commercial codes, with courts that will protect people from unfettered capitalism. It's easy to open a stock market. Even Mongolia has a stock market today. But it's very difficult to build a Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, that can control insider trading. It's easy to suddenly loosen the reins on the press and permit the free flow of economic information. But it's very difficult to establish and protect a truly independent free press that will expose corruption inside government and unmask flim-flam companies that are cheating their shareholders. This process of building software and operating systems is emerging as the weak link in the globalization chain. That is, we know now that globalization leads to more commerce, trade, and economic development. More economic development leads to more prosperity for more people, and more prosperity tends to lead to more pluralism and political liberalization. And greater liberalization tends to lead to democratization. But for this chain reaction to get going, your country needs to get its basic operating system and software in place. And taking this first step often clashes with the country's culture, history, and embedded institutions, or the lack of them. Therefore, this first step turns out to be much more difficult than originally thought in the euphoria that followed the fall of the Berlin Wall. Think about Poland and the Soviet Union. They emerged from the Cold War at roughly the same time. Both initially experienced economic downturns. Poland soon started growing, though, but Russia didn't. The reason was partly due to the fact that Poland, which had a history of capitalism before the communists took over, was able to put in place relatively quickly a lot of the basic software and operating systems needed to succeed in the globalization era. But Russia, with no history of capitalism or democracy, has had a much harder time, and paid the price. I always remember a joke that Secretary of State James A. Baker III told reporters traveling with him, a joke that Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev told him. Gorbachev was trying to underscore to Baker how difficult it was for Russia to make the psychological transition to capitalism after so many years of communism. And he did it with this yarn. A Russian peasant finds a lamp by the side of the road and rubs it. Out pops a genie. The genie tells the peasant he can have any wish. The peasant tells the genie, "You know, I have only 3 cows, but my neighbor Igor has 10 cows. "So you want 20 cows? The genie asks the peasant. "No," says the peasant. "I want you to kill 7 of Igor's cows." In the Cold War system, the big divide in the world was between communist and capitalist economies, with a few hybrids in between. Now that virtually everyone has the same hardware, the big divide in the world is increasingly going to be between free market democracies and free market kleptocracies. Those countries that are able to develop the operating systems and software to go with free markets will move in the direction of free market democracies. Those countries that are unable or unwilling to develop the software and operating systems will move in the direction of free market kleptocracies, where the state basically gets taken over by robber barons and criminal elements, none of whom have an interest in the real rule of law. Goodbye, communists versus capitalists. Hello, free market democrats versus free market kleptocrats. Since most people are familiar with what the best free market democracies look like, Let me illustrate what the worst free market kleptocracies look like. Then you can locate any country on the spectrum in between. The purest form of free market kleptocracy that I have ever seen was in Albania in the 1990s. Albania had been one of the most isolated communist countries for 50 years, having adopted a Maoist pro-China stance in the Cold War. Following the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the communist regime in Albania also collapsed in 1991. Rudimentary elections were held in Albania, and a quasi-democratic government was established in Tirana. Finally, the Albanians thought, "We are getting what everyone else has, free market hardware." Unfortunately, that's all they got. Albania was all hardware, with no software and no operating system. While I was visiting Tirana in 1998, Fatos Lubonia, a 47-year-old Albanian writer and editor of the Albanian literary journal Endeavor, described to me what it was like to live in the Albanian kleptocracy. "After communism," he said, "we had total equality here. We were all at zero. Few people had property or contacts, so a hierarchical system only emerged after that. Basically, people looked at politics as a business, because being a politician meant that you could open or close doors. You could give or not give stamps. The free market was considered free to do anything, so the boldest people started doing all sorts of things, and the criminals discovered that they needed politicians for some things, and politicians discovered they needed money to stay in power. People had no experience. They were not educated in government affairs. They did not realize that without the software, Albania would be a jungle. And so, people suffered, and many were kidnapped by gangsters or left the country. Soon, people realized that Albania could not compete in the free market except with an illegal economy. So we created this criminal bourgeoisie. They don't pay taxes, they are not responsible for the social lives of the people or for infrastructure. They just take and take. If you can't compete on microchips, you will compete on mafia. As for building a real free market democracy, we are at 0 point. The first 5 years were just the last mutation of communism. Instead of building a free market economy that would reward initiative and risk, we created a criminal economy linked with the pyramid schemes. People put their money in these pyramids, and instead of investing, they were just drinking coffee and waiting for money to come to them, which is what the pyramid owners promised. This reminded me of how we used to wait for aid from China and live off that in the Cold War. Whatever it was not real economics. Indeed, what happened in Albania was that instead of a proper banking system, the government tolerated and, to some degree, even nurtured Ponzi schemes, one of the oldest forms of swindle. So well established were these Ponzi schemes in Albania that one of the most brazen of them even sponsored an Italian race car team, as though it were MasterCard International. The organizer of a typical Ponzi scheme came to people and told them if they would deposit their savings in the fund, they would earn 20, 30, even 50% on their money in 6 months. Because the Ponzi funds had few, if any, real investments to earn such high returns on, the way they paid out this high interest was by constantly luring in new investors to pay off old ones, while always skimming a little cash off for the fund managers. It all works fine until you run out of new investors. The Ponzi schemes began with efforts to raise cash to finance the purchase of gasoline that could be smuggled at very high prices into neighboring Montenegro and Serbia, which were under international sanctions during the Balkan War. Carlos Elbert, head of the World Bank office in Tirana, explained to me. But after the sanctions were lifted on Serbia, there was no real business activity behind the Ponzi schemes, so they just became a business of getting new money to finance old money. When the people running these things were really desperate for new cash, they offered 50% interest on your money. It was hard for me to convince even my own Albanian World Bank staff that these Ponzi schemes were doomed to fall. My staff would nod their heads at my graphs and then put more money into their Ponzi scheme. They were just too tempting, and everyone was doing it. It was like a fever. People sold their homes and put the money in Ponzi schemes, and then in 2 or 3 months, they bought back their old home and a new one. The IMF and the central bank warned the Albanian government, money doesn't grow on trees, but the government would not step in. This was in part because the Albanian government did not have enough people who knew better, and in part because many of its own officials were caught up in Ponzi fever. If I went to an ambassador's residence on his country's national day, you would see an owner of the pyramid schemes there, said Albert. They were totally accepted and legitimized, and that is what led a lot of common people to them. Eventually, though, the Albanian pyramid saving fever. If I went to an ambassador's residence on his country's national day, you would see an owner of the pyramid schemes there, said Albert. They were totally accepted and legitimized, and that is what led a lot of common people to them. Eventually, though, the Albanian pyramid savings funds collapsed in 1997, as these things always do, leading to a total breakdown of law and order, with furious Albanians ransacking their own state in an effort to get their money back. Albert and other foreign diplomats had to be evacuated for their own safety. They drove in a British-organized convoy from Tirana to the port of Durres. Once they got to Durres, the helicopter that was supposed to lift them out couldn't land because there was so much shooting. So the convoy was moved to a different area of the port, which was controlled by the Italians. The diplomats had all been driven to Durres in their official cars with their official drivers, and their drivers were all parked in the port, waiting to take the cars back to Tirana. But anarchy reigned, and a group of half-drunk Albanian thieves set upon the port and began stealing all the cars. Albert said the most striking moment came when a thief showed up, took out a big, big gun, demanded the keys to the car of one of the evacuees, and then sped away with it, all in less than a minute. 10 minutes later, though, the thief returned and demanded all the official registration papers for the car he had just stolen. It was as though the thief had an inkling that just in case Albania ever got some software, he might need the ownership documents. Said Albert, he was very polite. Once the actual robbery was over, it seems he just wanted to make the transaction official. The story of Albania in the 1990s is an extreme example that proves a simple point. Those people who worried or predicted that because of globalization and the increasing irrelevance of borders, the nation-state would begin to wither away or diminish in importance are dead wrong. In fact, they speak utter nonsense. Because of globalization and the increasing openness of borders, the quality of your state matters more, not less. Let me repeat that a little louder. In the globalization system, your state matters more, not less. Because the quality of your state really means the quality of the software and operating system you have to deal with the electronic herd. The ability of an economy to withstand the inevitable ups and downs of the herd depends in large part on the quality of its legal system, financial system, and economic management, all matters still under the control of governments and bureaucrats. Chile, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore all survived the economic crisis of the 1990s so much better than their neighbors, because they had better quality states running better quality software and operating systems. Thai Prime Minister Chuan Lik Pai told me in early 1998, after his country got battered in the Asian economic crisis, if you are going to be part of this global market, you had better be able to defend yourself from this market. One of the lessons this crisis has taught us is that many of our structures and institutions were not ready for this new era. Now we have to adapt ourselves to meet international standards. The whole of society expects it. They are looking for better government and transparent government. But while the state matters more now, not less, what has changed is what we mean by the state. In the Cold War, it was the size of the state that mattered. You needed a big state to fight the communists, maintain the walls around your country, and sustain a generous welfare system to buy off your workers so they wouldn't go communist. In the era of globalization, it is the quality of the state that matters. You need a smaller state because you want the free market to allocate capital, not the slow, bloated government. But you need a better state, a smarter state, and a faster state, with bureaucrats that can regulate a free market without either choking it or letting it get out of control. The trick for governments today is to get the quality of their states up at the same time that they get the size of their states down. One of the most important and enduring competitive advantages that a country can have today is a lean, efficient, honest civil service. That's why the big issue for many of the former communist and hybrid state-dominated economies is whether once they start to get the size of their government down by liberalizing, deregulating, and privatizing their state-owned industries, they can also get the quality of their government up. Because less government without better government is really dangerous. You need a balance. You want a state that is strong enough and involved enough to maintain a level and fair playing field to ensure that the best innovators and entrepreneurs win, but not one that is so strong and so involved that it is either picking winners or protecting losers from winners or protecting losers from internal or external competition. If your market is all stoplights and no freeways, it breeds stagnation. And if your free market is all freeways and no stoplights, it breeds chaos. In the case of Russia and Albania, premature globalization after the collapse of communism led to all freeways and no stoplights. Russia plugged into the electronic herd with virtually no operating system and no software. As a result, Russia had people taking advantage of the privileges of a free market, taking in foreign investments, issuing stocks and bonds, making international loans, without sufficient oversight or taxation to generate incomes to pay the bondholders back. And when the herd finally realized that Russia was nothing more than a piece of free market hardware with no operating system or software inside, the herd surged and melted down the tangled mess of wires that made up the Russian economy. In post-communist Poland, the economy sagged and then surged as reforms kicked in, because investors found there was a level playing field there, where the most productive companies won. In Russia, you didn't do well by doing better or by operating in accordance with best practices, said Bill Lewis, who headed the McKinsey consulting firm's study of the Russian economy. You did well by seeking favors, tax preferences, and subsidies. What happened in Southeast Asia was another form of premature globalization. Thailand, Malaysia, South Korea, and Indonesia are different from Russia. They had rudimentary free market hardware all along, and they even had early versions of the operating system, from Das Kapital 3.0 to 4.0. These early versions of Das Kapital, when combined with lots of savings, lots of government-backed credit, lots of natural resources, and lots of people ready to labor very hard, worked well to get them from $500 per capita income to $5,000. Because as we all know, when you first get a computer, any operating system will do, and it will always make you more productive than you were with a typewriter. But these early versions of Das Kapital were relatively slow and rife with crony capitalism. In Indonesia, for instance, the management of state-owned banks was dominated by the finance ministry.
When politicians, members of the president's family, or finance ministry officials came calling, bankers felt compelled to extend loans, even for projects they figured would be unprofitable, and when repayment of the loans became doubtful, they concealed the problems, wrote Shiraishi Takashi, a Kyoto University expert on Southeastern Asian finance. Private sector banks were also accumulating bad debts. Their function was to serve the business groups that had set them up, and when a member of the group ran into trouble, they would lend it additional funds brought in from foreign sources at high interest rates. As the electronic herd shifted into high gear in the 1990s and increased in power from a 286 chip to a Pentium II, it offered these Southeast Asian countries more and more money. Local banks, most of which were barely regulated, started excessively buying dollars, converting them into local currencies at a fixed rate, not hedging them in any way, and then lending that money out to their cronies for an increasing number of non-productive investments, from one too many golf courses to the world's tallest office towers to egomaniacal expansions of South Korean conglomerates. The Southeast Asian nations needed to update their old Das Kapital 3.0 to 4.0 and move closer to Das Kapital 6.0. They needed more liberalized operating systems that would reduce the role of governments, let markets more freely allocate resources to their most productive uses, encourage more internal competition, and weed out losers through effective bankruptcy laws. And they needed more sophisticated software that would improve the quality of governance, regulate a faster, more open economy, discipline company managers, open them up for shareholder scrutiny, and be strong enough and flexible enough to handle any sudden large-scale withdrawal of foreign investment from the herd. Just throwing lots of capital and labor at an industry wasn't enough anymore to produce sustained high growth. Unfortunately, the Southeast Asians just stuck with Das Kapital 3.0. Big mistake. Das Kapital 3.0 was fine for getting from $500 to $5,000 per capita income when the herd was moving at the speed of a 286 chip. But when they wanted to move from $5,000 per capita income to $15,000 and the herd moved from a 286 chip to a Pentium II, and they were still running Das Kapital 3.0, their hardware naturally froze up. Have you ever seen what happens when you use an old, slow version of the DOS operating system and Windows software in a new Pentium II computer? What happens is that you get messages on your screen such as, "You have performed an illegal function," "Out of memory," and "Cannot save item." This, in short, is what happened to the Southeast Asians in 1997-98, only the messages that came up on their screens read, "You have performed a series of irrational investments. Cannot save items. Delete memory of all inefficient industries. Contact service provider and download new software and operating system." And this is what they have been trying to do ever since. What you found in all these Southeast Asian countries was that they replicated the outward configurations of the Western financial systems, but in many cases it was replication by rote. There was something missing inside, a key element of the DOS operating system. It was a basic feel and understanding of how real free markets and a free market-based society work. That they are not run by the arbitrary judgments of individuals, but by the anonymous working out of every value judgment in the marketplace. The huge Korean conglomerates, the so-called chaebols, would never have been able to build up the huge debt-to-equity ratios they did without the intervention of government officials arbitrarily directing capital their way. All this borrowing enabled them to grow at astronomical rates for a time, but in the end, it caught up with them. Former Korean Prime Minister Lee Hong-gu told me that it took his government several years to understand this. I was Prime Minister in 1995 when Korea was admitted to the OECD and reached $10,000 a year per capita income, he said. We thought we had really finally arrived. We thought that because we had graduated from high school with honors, we were going to be great college students. But the qualities needed at one stage were very different at the next. We didn't realize that our big state bureaucracy, which we were so proud of, was more a stumbling block than a positive force. We lived by the formula that manufacturing plus exports equals economic growth and success. We learned that was wrong from the crisis of the late 1990s, but the tuition is too high. We learned that the communist loss was a loss against capitalism, and if capitalism won, that meant that capital was in control. There was this rapid globalization of capital in the 1990s, but we had not prepared our institutions to deal with the global capital markets. We didn't have the mechanisms to deal with them. We were defenseless. We treated our banks as if they were a national service organization, as if they were an extension of government. We thought you should not make money from money. We thought you should make money from making things. So the job of banks was to promote growth. So they were part of the government bureaucracy. We didn't understand that banks and capital flows were the heart of the new economy, and either you reform them or else. As Harvard University economist Donnie Roderick has demonstrated through his own research, it is not whether you globalize that matters, it is how you globalize. Countries that have built up sophisticated, honest, and credible financial and legal infrastructures, and this takes time, are much better positioned to fend off speculative attacks on their currencies, are much better able to withstand sudden outflows of capital by the herd, and are much faster at taking steps to minimize their impact. Yes, there are some exceptions. Even a country with a sound operating system and software can run into trouble. Witness Sweden in 1992, or America and its savings and loan debacle. But Sweden and the United States also bounced back quickly because of the underlying quality of their operating systems and software. As Alan Greenspan has noted in speeches, those countries with advanced financial operating systems and software generally have been able to discourage speculative attacks against a well-trenched currency because their financial systems are robust and are able to withstand large and rapid capital outflows and to mobilize the often vigorous policy responses required to stem such attacks. For all these reasons, there is now a growing awareness among leaders of developing countries that what they need in order to succeed in the globalization system is not just an emerging market, but what former U.S. Ambassador to Hungary Donald Blinken called an emerging society. It does not pay to privatize your economy in a societal and governance vacuum. Putting the market before the society, said Blinken, is an invitation to trouble and disappointment. Therefore, it is critically important that both investors and politicians begin to broaden their definition of what constitutes a healthy emerging market by looking at what constitutes a healthy emerging society. In retrospect, the biggest mistake the world made with Russia when it succeeded the Soviet Union was casting Russia's transition into the global system as primarily a financial problem, and leaving it for the IMF to sort out, as if the only problem was freeing up prices the right way and trusting the free market to take care of everything. World Bank President James Wolfensohn has proposed that we revise our methodology for measuring countries from the current checklist, which is almost entirely confined to financial statistics, GDP, GNP, per capita income, to a new form of accounting that would measure a country's health as an emerging society, not just as an emerging market. Countries must be graded on the quality of their governing software, judicial system, procedures for settling disputes, social safety net, rule of law, and economic operating systems. These so-called second-generation reforms needed to produce an emerging society take a lot more patience and hard work. In the old days, a World Bank official once said to me, you came into a developing country and you went to the governor of the central bank and you had one simple piece of advice. Stop printing so much money. Then you went over to the minister of finance and said, stop running such a big budget deficit so your central bank can stop printing so much money. In other words, all you had to do was talk to two people and give two simple messages. But now we know that a lot more is required. And in order to get these second-generation software reforms in place, which really transform a country from an emerging market into an emerging society, you need to involve many, many more actors, and it requires a much, much wider political consensus. It has been said of America that it is a system designed by geniuses so that it could be run by idiots. What developing countries need most from America today is not aid. Rather, it is an understanding of what is the real source of American prosperity, the combination of the right operating system, free markets, with the right software, political institutions, and political consensus that can protect property and innovation, maintain a level playing field, ensure that the most productive players usually win, and provide some minimum safety nets to catch the losers. While all sorts of would-be Western geo-architects are talking about designing a new global central bank and new global governing institutions to control the electronic herd, leaders of many developing countries are coming to realize that none of that will protect them unless they have better local government. The bank laws and the legislatures that pass them, the executives and regulators who enforce them, and the courts that adjudicate them are all local institutions, and the focus must be on improving those bodies, not waiting for some celestial solution of global government. While many Western thinkers don't get this, the countries that have actually gone through economic crises in the 1990s get it very well. There are some voices, some very loud voices, saying that perhaps integration has gone too far and too quickly, especially in financial markets. Mexico's president, Ernesto Cedillo, told me in the winter of 1997, well, I happen to believe just the opposite. Globalization poses challenges, but it offers tremendous opportunities. The fact that finance capital can move instantaneously indeed poses a risk, but jumping from that to say that we need to control movements of capital is totally wrong. Yes, he added, we need a strong IMF to help in emergencies and to alert us to distortions in countries or individual banks. But at the end of the day, said President Cedillo, all of these global financial flows end up in a local financial system, or as resources to be lent by local banks. So what matters, he added, is whether you have the local financial and political institutions to properly regulate the whole process. In the Cold War, countries did not care very much what sort of operating system or software their neighbors had, since they were not highly integrated. But today, in the globalization era, the ability of the herd to transmit instability from bad countries to good countries has vastly increased. The domino theory today belongs to the world of finance, not politics. That's why one has to be a bit worried about the quick recovery the Asian economies made from the crisis of 1997-98. It wasn't because they had actually put in place all the reforms they needed to upgrade from Das Kapital 1.0 to 6.0. In many cases, it was because their currencies had become very cheap, and they were the beneficiaries of strong U.S. demand for imports, particularly of electronics and computer parts made in Southeast Asia. The Wall Street Journal, October 28, 1999, profiled Indonesia's Rini Soewandi, who was appointed head of the Indonesia automaker Astra International after the company was nearly wiped out by Asia's late 1990s economic downturn. She really expressed the growing awareness among Asian entrepreneurs of the changes that they need to put in place to thrive, but also how difficult they are to put in place. "I follow the American way of doing business, but in my soul, I'm a Javanese," said the 41-year-old Ms. Soewandi. The article then went on to say the following. Ms. Soewandi is making a tough leap, attempting to transform the business soul of Astra, one of Southeast Asia's oldest and largest companies, from a clubby conglomerate to one of the region's first American-style public corporations. The remaking of Astra signals the start of a new struggle for Southeast Asia as it looks beyond the crisis. With the worst behind them, many companies are waking up to the longer-term problem of surviving in a newly opened market. Most have avoided the issue, hoping that recovery will restore their fortunes. But Astra is meeting its troubles head-on and effecting a cultural makeover, moving from profligacy to transparency, from ego-driven conglomerate to market-driven niche player. "It's a race against time," Ms. Soewandi says. "We're trying to do two huge things at once, survive the crisis and invent an entirely new business model that will carry us into the future. It's very difficult for a company to do one, let alone both." While the rest of the world clearly has a stake in how these Asian trading partners manage their internal economic affairs, the ability of the U.S. government or any others to actually help them build the necessary software is very limited. They have to come to the task on their own. The U.S. Secretary of State likes to shuttle in an airplane, but to build software, you have to shuttle in a taxi cab, from the local Ministry of Justice to the stock market, to the Ministry of Trade, to the corporate headquarters. This is the stuff of micro-politics and micro-diplomacy, which is totally foreign to most of today's diplomats. So, how to get at it? It would be nice if every society were able to get all its software and operating systems in place before it ever plugs into the electronic herd. But that is not realistic. The process is going to be much more chaotic. Two steps forward, one step back. We now know it will be a process of countries such as Russia or Brazil or Thailand plugging in a little, getting burned by the herd, and the herd getting burned by them, both of them learning certain lessons, implementing reforms, bouncing back a little, getting slapped down again, and then beginning the whole process anew, hopefully each time in a wiser manner. This is going to be a long, drawn-out learning process, one that could take a generation in a country such as Russia, that will dominate domestic politics and international relations in the era of globalization. In this dialectical process, the supermarkets and the electronic herd could end up playing a more important role than the American superpower in driving political reform. It would be great if every democracy movement could be spurred by a hero like Andrei Sakharov. It would be wonderful if every country could be nudged toward the rule of law by reading James Madison. But in the era we are heading into, the main engine of change could well be Merrill Lynch. The next chapter explains why. Chapter 9. Globalution. Story number one. In the winter of 1998, I interviewed the Prime Minister of Thailand, Chuan Leakpai. Half joking, half serious, I began the interview by looking across the table at him and saying, "Mr. Prime Minister, I have a confession to make. I helped oust your predecessor, and I didn't even know his name. You see, I was sitting home in my basement watching the Thai baht sink, and watching your predecessor completely mismanage your economy, so I called my broker and told him to get me out of East Asian emerging markets. I could have sold you out myself via the internet, but I decided to get my broker's advice instead. It's $1, one vote, Mr. Prime Minister. How does it feel to have Tom Friedman as a constituent?" The Prime Minister laughed,
but he knew just what I meant. Joining the global economy and plugging into the electronic herd is the equivalent of taking your country public. It is the equivalent of turning your country into a public company. Only the shareholders are no longer just your own citizens. They are the members of the electronic herd, wherever they might be. And as I noted earlier, they don't just vote once every 4 years. They vote every hour, every day, through their mutual funds, their pension funds, their brokers, and more, from their own basements via the Internet. Story number two. In the fall of 1997, I visited Moscow with a delegation of American business executives and academics. Our group included Donald Rice, the former chief operating officer of the American high-tech giant Teledyne, now head of a biotechnology firm. During the visit, Don mentioned to me one day that he had been discussing business opportunities with a Russian entrepreneur who was interested in partnering with an American company. Rice is a seasoned business executive, and before he went very far with the Russian businessman, he asked him a simple question. "Have you paid your taxes?" The Russian entrepreneur said, "Well, not exactly." "Sorry," Rice told him. If he had not paid his taxes, there was no way they could be partners, because Rice's company was a public company, and if one of its international subsidiaries wasn't paying its taxes, this would show up in Rice's annual audit. So the Russian entrepreneur now has a choice. He can be a bad Russian citizen, continue not to pay his Russian taxes, and compete alone. Or he could become a better Russian citizen and possibly partner with a cutting-edge American firm. The more countries link up with the herd, the more they will face the choice of Don Rice's Russian entrepreneur. Either run with the electronic herd and live by its rules, or run alone and live by your own rules, but accept the fact that you are going to have less access to capital, less access to technology, and ultimately, a lower standard of living for your people. What these two stories vividly illustrate are the conflicting effects that globalization has on democratization. The electronic herd will, on balance, pressure countries to put in place better software and operating systems that constitute the building blocks of democracy. At the same time, though, the electronic herd and the supermarkets are fast becoming two of the most intimidating, coercive, intrusive forces in the world today. They leave many people feeling that whatever democracy they have at home, whatever choices they think they are exercising in their local or national elections, whoever they think they elected to run their societies, are all just illusions. Because it is actually larger, distant, faceless markets and herds that are dictating their political lives. The paradox of globalization is that some days the herd rides into town like the Lone Ranger, guns blazing, demanding the rule of law, and the next day it stomps right out of town like King Kong, squashing everyone in its path. One day the herd is 1776, and the next day, it's 1984. Let me show you how it can be both at once. I call the process by which the herd helps to build the foundation stones of democracy revolution from beyond, or globolution. I first discovered globolution in Indonesia during a visit in 1997 in the waning months of the Suharto era. I was having dinner with Wimar Witoelar, a popular Jakarta talk show host, who was describing for me the young generation of the Indonesian middle class. He remarked that what many of these educated 20- and 30-year-olds had in common was that they wanted to get rich without having to be corrupt, and they wanted democracy, but they didn't want to go in the streets and fight for it. This generation of Indonesians understood that under Suharto there would never be a democratic revolution from above, but they were terrified of democratic revolution from below, because if the urban poor revolted, it would be the year of living dangerously all over again. So their whole strategy was revolution from beyond,
or Globolution. Their whole strategy was to do everything they could, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously, to integrate Indonesia into the global system. They hoped that by tying Indonesia into these global institutions and markets, whether it was to the World Trade Organization, Pizza Hut, APEC, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, Merrill Lynch, PricewaterhouseCoopers, or human rights non-governmental organizations, NGOs, they might be able to import from beyond the standards and rules-based systems that they knew would never be initiated from above and could never be generated from below. For instance, the Indonesian press couldn't directly rebuke the Suharto regime for its rampant nepotism, so instead it reported with great relish on how the United States and Japan were taking Indonesia before a WTO court to protest the fact that Indonesia's national car factory, then controlled by the president's son, was being protected by tariffs out of line with WTO standards. The strategy of Indonesia's globolutionaries was, in short, to Gulliverize the Suharto regime by globalizing Indonesian society. Indonesian military analyst Juwono Sudarsono described globolution to me as meaning that the global market will force upon us business practices and disciplines that we cannot generate internally. Another Indonesian reformer expressed it more simply. He told me that he and his son get their revenge on Suharto once a week by eating at McDonald's. The traditional foreign policy establishment, particularly the far left and far right, underestimate the power of the electronic herd and globalization to contribute to democratization. As Johns Hopkins University foreign policy expert Michael Mandelbaum notes, "We still live with the image of the revolutions of 1776, 1789, 1917, and 1989, which leaves the impression that democracy can only be produced by people rising up and throwing out a corrupt government. It is either the Minutemen on Lexington Common, or the throngs in Paris storming the Bastille, or solidarity rising in Poland, or people power rising in the Philippines. As such, our image of how democratization happens is never that some foreign businessman shows up and tells your government that he can't make enough money to employ that country's people unless that government institutes better legal safeguards, international accounting standards, and transparency. Just because the United States does not every day order China to democratize, and just because the Chinese people are not rising up every day demanding the right to write op-ed pieces in the Asian Wall Street Journal, doesn't mean that a process of democratization isn't being nurtured there. We keep looking at democratization as an event, like the fall of the Berlin Wall, but actually, it's a process. Of course, for this process of democratization to end up in successful liberal democracy, it needs to be pushed by more than just market forces, notes Larry Diamond, co-editor of the Journal of Democracy, and one of the most thoughtful scholars on worldwide democratization trends. The herd is necessary, but not sufficient. It is also important that the United States government speak out forcefully and consistently for democratization, he explained. It is important that the European Union and the United Nations Development Program and the ever-widening network of non-governmental organizations that monitor and promote human rights support democratization initiatives in emerging markets. It is important that the globalization of information is constantly informing more and more people about how others live. It is important that economic development within countries creates new middle classes around the world, with their natural demands for more participation in decision-making and political pluralism. It is not an accident that every country with a per capita income above $15,000 is a liberal democracy, except Singapore, which is a city-state, and almost certainly will become a liberal democracy once there is a generational change.
It is important that the end of the Cold War and the collapse of communism have discredited all models other than liberal democracy. You need all these factors working together. My simple point is that not only will the electronic herd and the supermarkets take their place among these other forces that Diamond explains are critical for promoting democratization, but in this era of globalization, the herd and the supermarkets may well turn out to be the most important of these forces. This is because of the herd's ability to get deep inside the wiring of countries in ways that governments and even human rights organizations cannot. The herd can impose pressures that few governments can resist. It has a self-interest in doing so, and it generates in others the self-interest to comply. To be sure, the herd is driven to get inside that wiring not because it values democracy per se. It doesn't. It values stability, predictability, transparency, and the ability to transfer and protect its private property from arbitrary or criminal confiscation. But to secure these things, the herd needs developing countries to put in place better software, operating systems,